I'm Thea Card with a check of the KDLG local news. The Alaska Energy Authority has responded to letters from the National Marine Fisheries Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that questioned research being done on the Susitna Hydroelectric Project. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
Of the two federal agencies, the National Marine Fisheries Service took a stronger position regarding AEA's ability to produce accurate models of salmon activity in the Susitna River. The NIMF's letter cited 14 areas of concern, including sampling methods and possible misidentification of juvenile fish. The agency says that the problems are significant enough that no further studies should be done until they're resolved. On Wednesday, AEA labeled the criticism as inaccurate. In a news release, Susitna Watonna project manager Wayne Dyock says the NIMF's letter, quote, relies on mischaracterizations and generalizations. The actual response letter by AEA, which is signed by Dyock, goes even further, saying that assertions made by the Fisheries Service are untenable, bordering on the absurd. AEA's response letter to the National Marine Fisheries Service totals nearly 50 pages. Most of that is a line-by-line refutation of the concerns listed by NIMFS. Many of AEA's specific responses assert that NIMFS is either ignoring the data or misunderstands the methodologies being used. The Alaska Energy Authority maintains that it is following the study plan approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. FERC will have the opportunity to hear out both sides soon. Meetings are scheduled to start next week to discuss the Susitna Watonna fieldwork. Part of the objective of those meetings is for FERC to decide what, if any, changes need to be made in future field studies. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
The Coast Guard Air Station Kodiak crews opened a seasonal forward operation location in Cold Bay on Sunday. The Coast Guard air crews transferred equipment to Cold Bay to reduce response time to Bristol Bay, the Bering Sea, and the Aleutian Islands. Petty Officer Kelly Parker says the Coast Guard picks forward operating locations based on how busy it is in the area.
A lot of activity going on, whether it's fishing, and so that our response times can be quicker, if there's any mariners in distress.
Parker says Cold Bay is perfectly placed for easy access to fisheries, and the all-weather airport made it ideal.
The infrastructure, that's already in Cold Bay helps us to, for us to use, our C-130s, airplanes, or our helicopters. It provides that infrastructure.
Lieutenant Bernie Garrigan says these FOLs are important because they ensure the safety of mariners during peak fishing seasons. A Coast Guard cutter with an MH-65 Dolphin helicopter crew will be on patrol in the Bering Sea during the majority of the season. MH-60 Jayhawk helicopter crews deployed to Cold Bay with rotate helicopter personnel each week, as well as logistic flights by Kodiak Base HC-130 Hercules airplane crews through April of 2015. The 40-odd residents of False Pass have waited years to find out if their turbulent seas could ever be used as a source of energy. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, they may finally have an answer and a path to renewable power.
False Pass sits at the very edge of the Aleutian Chain. The only thing separating it from mainland Alaska is a narrow strip of water with a lot of oomph behind it. Chris Emmerich is False Pass's city clerk.
I mean, you can just see it being on the dock. You watch it rolling by. If you put your fishing line out there, it's dragged, 50 yards within a matter of a minute.
That force prompted a team of scientists, engineers, and utility experts to kick off an investigation. Now, after almost 3 years, they've come up with a plan to save False Pass money and fuel by making power with a high-tech ocean turbine. It's kind of like harnessing wind, says lead scientist Bruce Wright. But the ocean's more predictable.
Also, water is a couple hundred times more dense than air, so we should be able to produce an awful lot of electricity.
Enough for 5 towns the size of False Pass, according to their research. That didn't come as a shock, but the exact source of energy did. Wright used to think that a wide-ranging coastal current system was speeding past as it traveled to the Arctic, and he thought False Pass could be the first town in the country to harness that current system for power. But when researchers dropped a meter into the water, that's not what they saw.
Oh, man, it's only the best tidal current we've ever measured.
Tides are still pretty new, but they have been used for energy before. And that means a shorter timeline for getting False Pass hooked up.
If we get funding, it could happen in 4 years. You know, if we can get our permits squared away, maybe less than that.
Besides permitting, the next step is finding the right spot to put a turbine underwater. It should be where the tides are strongest, but it can't be too far from town to avoid the need for expensive transmission lines. Either way, the cost will be steep, somewhere between $5 and $7 million, according to the turbine manufacturer. Ocean Renewable Power Company has been running tests around the state, and they have their eye on False Pass. Manager Monty Worthington says they wouldn't install anything without running the numbers.
To assure that this would be a benefit to the community, not just in the environmental sense, but in the sense of saving them money on their energy and stabilizing their energy costs.
Electric rates are triple the national average in False Pass, and they can go higher depending on the cost of diesel. Just getting that fuel can be a challenge. Last year, the commercial supplier for False Pass shut down. The local government and city clerk Chris Emmerich scrambled to fill the gap.
So we had to convert one of our tanks into a stove oil tank, and the city's been selling gas. And I'll be so glad when I don't have to deal with that too.
As of this month, the Community Development Quota Group for the Aleutian Islands is taking over. They built a new fuel storage facility to go with their newly remodeled fish plant. The Bering Pacific Seafoods Factory has been expanded so it can stay open year-round. Processing fish takes a lot of power, and having stable demand should help an expensive tidal energy system pencil out. At least, that's the argument that Emmerich and others are making as they apply for grants to keep the project moving forward. If tidal power works in False Pass,
the next village down, it'll get cheaper, and as these get to be more mainstream, hopefully they'll become very cost-effective within a few years after that.
And hopefully that would create a rising tide of affordable and clean energy around the state. And on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
The University of Alaska system leaders are considering placing a ban on tobacco use on all campuses. The ban, which would go into effect as soon as next year, comes after student pressure and a larger shift away from public tobacco use. With growing fiscal concerns for the university system and the budget tightening, system president Pat Gamble said the health and productivity costs of an employee who smokes are more than $5,000. The Bureau of Land Management transferred land to Alaska Peninsula Corporation, successor in interest to New Halen Native Corporation. This fulfills the corporation's final land entitlement under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act for New Halen. Acting chief of the Office of Communications for BLM in Alaska, KJ Mushevic, says BLM has closed 100 villages so far.
That means that the corporation established by ANCSA to represent a village has received all the acreage it is entitled to under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act.
This final land patent for New Halen of 12,300 acres means the village has received over 73,000 acres of land surrounding it. Mushevic says the land patents provide a land base to the Native corporations.
In many cases, the corporations have had title to their land for many years in the form of an interim conveyance, but a survey is required to complete the formal patent process. And so the confirmatory patent more legally describes the lands that may have been interimly conveyed at an earlier date, and that's the completion of that process. Sometimes lands are patented right from the beginning without the interim conveyance step, but the patent is the final piece.
She says there are over 100 BLM lands that are still in various stages of the patent process in Alaska. The Ketchikan Gateway Borough Assembly rejected an ordinance on Monday that would have added prayer to the regular meeting agenda. The issue was controversial, with many people taking one side or the other during public comment. KRBD's Leela Carey has more.
Borough Assembly chambers were packed, and most were there because of the proposed prayer ordinance. 10 spoke in favor, and many others stood up when asked who in the audience wanted prayer added to assembly meetings. Many of the speakers were ministers. Fred Adams is pastor of a Free Methodist church in Ward Cove. He says giving a little time to the supreme being has always brought a blessing.
I believe that this blessing has caused our nation to prosper in a very powerful way.
Jeff White of the Lighthouse Church of God notes that the Pledge of Allegiance includes a prayer and that prayer is a historic tradition in the United States. Pastor Bill White of that same church says there are many people in other nations who pray fervently.
I don't think any of us, if we get an opportunity to pray here, will command the whole group to bow five times on their face and pray, or any other system like that. But there are those who's praying against what you're doing, against what you represent.
Gary Souza of the Ketchikan Church of Christ says he respects those who disagree, but he believes Ketchikan would benefit from more prayer.
The real issue is whether or not you believe that in your personal wisdom that you can make better decisions by yourself as this governing body than you can by appealing to Almighty God. That's a rhetorical question. Of course you cannot.
Two speakers turned in petitions bearing signatures of those in favor of prayer before meetings. On the other side of the issue were eight speakers. Don Westland says the assembly is not a church. It's a place of government business.
You will alienate me from this assembly if you pass Ordinance 1740, because I do not believe in God, and there's other people who probably do not.
Becky King says that just because prayer is traditional or that other legislative bodies are praying or have prayed in the past doesn't mean the Ketchikan Assembly should make it part of the agenda.
Giving prayer an official place on the agenda makes me feel that if I do not pray and do not participate, you will not give my opinions the same weight as someone who does. I will not be voting for anyone who supports this proposal. You are here to unite the community, not needlessly divide it.
During assembly discussion of the issue, several members noted that there is nothing in borough code that prevents anyone from offering a prayer during the regular public comment. But by placing prayer on the agenda, Alan Bailey says he's worried the assembly would alienate some members of the community. John Harrington described his devoutly religious background and his belief that prayer would help the assembly make better decisions. He went on to say that he was not in favor of the ordinance.
This is something that is personal between us and our Creator. It is something we need to bring to this table as a part of our decision-making process.
Assembly member Glenn Thompson was one of the sponsors of the ordinance. When it became clear that it wasn't going to pass, he offered an amendment that would have placed the issue in front of voters during the next regular municipal election.
I think this is an important question. I think there are people who personally believe around this table that it's something we should do, but I think they also feel that it's not necessarily our place as the seven people around this table to make a question of this magnitude and this importance for the people. And therefore, by putting this section in here and passing the ordinance as a referendum to the people, we'll put the question in front of the voters. Thank you.
The amendment failed, although Harrington and Bailey say they would welcome such a ballot proposition if it came before them as a citizens' initiative. The main motion to add prayer to the regular assembly agenda failed in a 2-5 vote. Thompson and Assemblymember Jim Van Horn voted yes. After the vote, Pastor Bill White asked for a clarification. He wanted to make sure it would be okay for him or anyone else to offer a prayer during public comment, not part of the regular meeting agenda. Mayor David Landis said the presiding officer has leeway on that issue.
Personally, I would enjoy hearing from you.
Okay, thank you.
Later, Assemblymember Todd Phillips said he was a little worried that public comment might be taken over by people coming to pray. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla.
A new report from Oregon says Alaska's workers' compensation premium rate is dropping. The Oregon Workers' Compensation Premium Rate Ranking Summary is based on methods that put states' workers' compensation rates on a comparable basis. The study uses classification codes from the National Council on Compensation Insurance. Research analyst with the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services, Jay Dotter, says the report starts with a survey sent out to every state.
What we're trying to do is come up with a comparison of workers' comp cost between states. It's going to include what we call the loss cost, which are the part of the premium that goes for paying claims now and future. The other part is everything else that goes into it, the assessments, what the insurer needs to charge to make money on it. And we're trying to come up with this equivalent index rate that compares all the states together.
The report is conducted once every 2 years. However, the report is specifically designed to help Oregon compare itself to other states. There are some states like Alaska that lump all trucking together into one category, but there are several different kinds in Oregon. The analysts simply make basic categories that are similar among all 50 states and the District of Columbia. Dotter says the main reason he sees Alaska's premium going down has to do with the lowering cost of medical care and less number of claims.
Make the workplace safer, and you have fewer claims, and that helps keep the cost down.
Alaska employers paid about $300 million in workers' compensation insurance premiums in 2013. Those lower premiums saved Alaska businesses about $6 million in 2014. Director of the Alaska Division of Workers' Compensation, Michael Monagle, says although it's definitely worth noting Alaska's new rating, it's not because of any policy change.
You know, we've had, again, over a four-year period, about a 4% decrease in overall costs. For us, for Alaska, those declines are primarily because of frequency. That is, the number of injuries that happen each year. If you look back, about 20 years ago, Alaska had over 30,000 reported injuries per year. This last year, for which we have data for calendar year 2013, that's dropped down to about 19,000 reported injuries.
Alaska ranks fifth behind California, Connecticut, New Jersey, and New York. Monagle says he noticed the other states that were in the top 10 with Alaska.
Of the top 10 states, five of them are located in the Northeast, where if you look at some of the data, the cost for medical treatment in the Northeast states is very high, like it is in Alaska.
In 2002, Alaska ranked 15th, but by 2006, Alaska was up to first in premiums. The Juneau School District has spent at least $20,000 investigating and dealing with last May's hazing incident, where seven incoming seniors paddled six incoming freshmen. As Lisa Fu reports, the school district is trying to move forward proactively.
As an athlete at Juneau Douglas High School, junior John Scudder doesn't think hazing is an issue. He's been playing soccer and tennis since freshman year.
I think that it got carried away this one time, but I do not think it's a problem.
John says he hasn't noticed an uptick of anti-bullying or anti-hazing messages from his coaches or teachers since the paddling.
At the beginning of the sport, whatever it is, every student gets a talk about how bullying is not all right, drugs are not all right, just the standard talk about all the things that you can't do if you want to participate in these sports. And I think it's pretty standard every single year.
During the Juneau School Board's September meeting, State Education Commissioner Mike Hanley said athletic coaches are partly responsible for changing the culture of hazing. A couple weeks later, Juneau School District Superintendent Mark Miller says he met with around 80 middle and high school coaches and activity instructors during two closed meetings.
I made it clear, and everybody was on the same page before, I just reiterated that hazing and bullying is not acceptable and that coaches need to be proactive in stopping it and report it immediately if they find out that it's occurred.
The district is in discussions with Gonzalez Marketing, an advertising and media firm in Anchorage. Miller says the firm will train sports and activity staff on how to more effectively communicate with media, parents, and students. He says how staff represents the district is important.
All coaches have at one time or another said something that they, in retrospect, would take back or speak differently. And so this is just a way to get everybody together and do some practicing.
The district is also sending two staff members to Arizona for intensive training on restorative justice, an alternative to traditional punishments of suspension and expulsion. It focuses on promoting respect, taking responsibility, and strengthening relationships. Miller says the goal is to implement a restorative justice plan throughout the district.
sending kids home from school as punishment has been shown to be terribly ineffective in both changing behavior and in improving the quality of education in the district.
The district never released who was punished for the May hazing incident or how they were disciplined due to student privacy rights. John Scudder says he doesn't need to know what the punishment was. As a student, he thinks the message on hazing is clear.
People have realized that, like, if you do it, you will get caught and that it's not all right.
He just wants everyone to focus on the positive.
I feel like there was an incident that was a problem, but that's in the past and that we can move on. And I think we've learned from it and that we can be a stronger community as a whole.
John will be a senior next year, and he plans to welcome the incoming class with the same respect and encouragement he received as a freshman. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
That's a check of the KDLG Local News. In Dillingham, I'm Thea Card reporting.